working with the first hindrance, which is known as craving or wanting mind or sensual desire, you know, I will get into like what is a hindrance and what are the five hindrances. We'll talk about that. And then we'll dive into craving and how that shows up and some of the impacts of that in our practice, in our life. And eventually we'll get to the antidotes, because the great thing about the Buddha is every time he introduced a problem, he brought out a solution. I love that about him. Yeah. So there's a quote by the Buddha that went on the website when this was advertised on the newsletter, and it says, "Your worst enemy cannot harm you as much as your unguarded thoughts." So the Buddhist tradition speaks directly about the five hindrances that we encounter on our spiritual journey. And the Buddha said that those who conquer their minds are greater than those who defeat 1,000 men 1,000 times in a battle. And almost every experienced meditator, I'm sure many of you can agree, can describe in detail hours or years of dealing with one version or another of various hindrances. These are disruptions of the mind and the heart that show up in our practice, both on the cushion and in our daily lives, because our practice doesn't stop when we get up off the cushion, hopefully. And the thing about these difficult energies are that they were described by Christian and Jewish mystics, Sufis, Hindus, American Indian shamans. So we're not alone. And when we imagine our own minds, we inevitably encounter the root forces of greed, fear, prejudice, hatred, desire. And these create so much sorrow in the world. But when we encounter these, it becomes an opportunity for us and raises a central question for anyone undertaking the spiritual life. Is there a way to work with these energies? It's not just contemporary problems. In the second century, the Christian mystics known as the Desert Fathers taught their students about the hindrances by describing them in terms of demons that come to one who meditates out in the wilderness. They include fear, irritation, gluttony, laziness, and pride. In the Buddhist tradition, we often refer to them, or they're personified by Mara, the tempter, who appeared before the Buddha as he attempted to enter into enlightenment. And Mara, these energies, this temptress, was bound and determined to keep him from finding the freedom from suffering that he was so committed to finding. And so we see this a lot in different spiritual teachings. One of them shows up in the great Tibetan saint Milarepa. And I'll share a story with you that some of you may have heard. I don't remember exactly, what was he, like 12th century, 13th century, something like that? And maybe somebody knows. And so here he is, this Tibetan yogi, living in these caves, committing his life to meditation and freedom of suffering. And one evening he returns to his cave after gathering firewood, only to find it filled with demons. They were cooking his food, reading his books, sleeping in his bed. They'd basically taken over the joint. Now, he knew about non-duality of self and others, but he didn't quite know how to get these guys out of his cave. And even though he had a sense that they were just a projection of his own mind, the unwanted parts of himself, he just didn't know how to get rid of them. So he started out, he says, well, I'll teach him the Dhamma. So he starts giving them these teachings that he was so well versed in. Sat on a seat that was higher than them, you know. and said things to them about compassion and emptiness and how poison is medicine, and basically nothing happened. The demons were still there. And then he lost his patience and started running around and screaming at him, and they just laughed. So finally he gave up, sat down on the floor, and said, "I'm not going away. Looks like you're not either. So let's just live here together." At that point, all of them left except one. Oh, this one was particularly vicious. We all know that one. Sometimes we've got a lot of those. Sometimes it feels like it's all we've got. But he didn't know what to do, so he decided, well, I need to just surrender even more. So he walked over, put himself right into the mouth of the demon and said, "Just eat me up if you want to. I give up." And the demon left. So all these demons, these hindrances, appear in our fear, our habits, our anger, our resistance, our unwillingness to look at what is actually happening. And until we actually surrender, like Milarepa did, to this demon, and just allow ourselves to see what's really happening and allow ourselves to be consumed by that, they're going to continue to hang out in our cave. You know, and we experience them in our stories if we're mindful enough. We can experience them. And sometimes we feel them in our bodies. Now, by watching people around him, the Buddha found out that the causes of suffering are craving, desire, and ignorance, which was basically what he taught in the Second Noble Truth. The Second Noble Truth seeks to determine the cause of suffering. The first one is that suffering, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness is pervasive in our life. The second one is, what are the causes? And the causes are craving, ignorance, and craving, desire, and ignorance. So when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he vowed not to get up until he had come to the fullest understanding and freedom possible for a human. It's so funny because somebody pointed out my shirt earlier. This just happened to be an accident. I work with people in recovery, and this was a shirt I picked up from one of the places. Did you know the promise is freedom? This could be our new Asheville Insight Meditation t-shirt. It just kind of fits right in, doesn't it? So he knew, he was determined to find the fulfillment of freedom. So to understand it, we have to do what he did, which is face Mara, to face these demons. And our journey, our practice, is through the realms of the mind, because the Buddha taught, he said, this is the one thing I teach. He said that I only teach the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering. And he said that since that our suffering begins in the mind. It's not the control of trying to make something happen, but the ability to stay open and present and balanced through the experiences and realms of life. It is possible to train the heart and the mind. It's possible to overcome and transform the forces of Mara. So, I mentioned the five hindrances. Craving is the first one, also referred to as sensual desire. The second one is often referred to as ill will, hatred, aversion. The third is dullness, drowsiness, or as we like to say, sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor. Restlessness is number four, which is the flip, right, of drowsiness. And the last one is doubt. But we're going to focus on number one, the first hindrance. And it basically comes down to one thing, grasping for an experience different than where we're at. It's the mindset of, I don't like what's happening right now. I want a different experience. I need to change this. I need to fix this. Rather than just saying, well, I'm going to accept it. So The Buddha said, he said, one whose heart is overwhelmed by unrestrained covetousness, will do what he should not do and neglect what he ought to do. And through that, his good name and happiness will come to ruin. Kind of sounds like modern politics to me. So, what are the things that we crave? Food we love to eat, entertainment, new toys like smartphones and super cool apps, and popularity, money, beauty, holidays, Dharma books, bigger house, a smaller house, a thinner body, a better Dharma talk, enlightenment, and whatever. It just depends on where we're at. We might call it the if-only syndrome. If only this or that were different. We could be at work, at home, with friends, on vacation, stuck in traffic, on retreat. In fact, maybe especially on retreat. You know, I've done a number of retreats out at Southern Dharma Retreat Center up by Hot Springs. And when I go out there on retreat, they have work practice. So one of the things you do is you rake leaves or clean bathrooms or fold towels or do staff work for them or work in the kitchen. Well, I always sign up for the kitchen because I really like being in the kitchen. Plus, it's warm, it's not raining, it's not cold. But there's one problem. The work practice is in the morning, so I always know what's for lunch. So guess what happens the last meditation before lunch? Guess what wanting mind is happening in this brain, in this mind? Oh my God, they're making that amazing tofu tikka masala again. And, you know, I'm just like crazy about it. And I remember one retreat, Anthony, who's kind of famous as a cook out there, he asked me to chop up some peaches, cut them all up in small pieces. And then I happened to notice over on the side he had some pie crusts. Well, a lot of times on the last day they would offer dessert. And then I wandered over, opened the freezer, and sure enough, ice cream. And that last sit before lunch on the last day, I could not get peach pie a la mode out of my mind. Wanting mind. And then there's the Vipassana romance. Anybody heard about the Vipassana romance? Anybody had one? That's where you go on retreat. And the first day, maybe, the second day, you're sitting there and you have to look across the room and you notice this guy or this gal. And it's like, okay. And then by the second day or the third day, you're thinking, wow, we would make a great couple. You know, I like the way they look. They're meditators. Geez, this could really work out. By day six, you've already gotten married, bought the house with the picket fence and the two cars, got a couple kids, you know, if you're still young. And the whole deal is worked out. And you don't even know their name. Right? Paul, you're nodding your head. Sounds like you've been there. I mean, it's hysterical. But this is just another example of how this happens. So sensual desire, you know, it's common in meditation. It can take on so many forms. When we're doing our practice, oh, I need a softer zafu. The room's too warm. The room's too cold. Somebody open the window. Somebody close the window. And the thing is, it's all of this stuff, it's actually built into our neurobiology. I mean, we're hardwired to wanting, at some level, wanting things to be different. It's you know, just to continue our evolution as a species. The midbrain, the survival brain, as it's often called, which controls primal life-sustaining, life survival skills, this brain is always looking for danger. And, you know, the reptilian brain that deals with states of arousal, you know, this is constantly looking for ways to respond. So, you know, if we want a warmer room, i.e. cave, it might be really important to find that, because if we don't, we might not survive. And those hunger pains, instead of peach pie, it might be something that we really need in order to survive. It might be something that a mother needs to nurture that child so that the child is healthy when it's born. It's built right into our neurobiologies. But how many of us are craving a cave and a firewood, you know, some firewood today? Maybe not so much. So, you know, but the problem with these cravings is sometimes it can really create some unexpected challenges. Like, for example, there was this one guy who had a lot of sexual desire, and he was having an affair with this Italian woman, and one night she confided to him that she was pregnant. Well, not wanting to ruin his reputation or his marriage, he paid her a large sum of money if she would go to Italy and secretly have the child over there. If she stayed in Italy to raise the child, he'd provide plenty of child support until the child turned 18. Just keep it to yourself. She agreed, but then said, well, how will you know when the baby is born? He said, well, let's keep it discreet. Simply mail me a postcard and just write on the back, spaghetti. And I know the child has arrived. So, and then he would know that it was time to arrange for the child support payments. You know? So one day, about 9 months later or so, he came home to his confused wife. She says, honey, you received a very strange postcard today. Oh, really? Let me see. The wife gave the card to him and watched her husband as he read the card, turned white, and fainted. On the card was written, spaghetti, spaghetti, spaghetti. Two with meatballs, one without, send extra sauce. Wanting mind, yes. So, you know, living without wants, wishes, motivations, aspirations, these are healthy, useful, appropriate, but some are not, clearly. So the function of mindfulness practice is to distinguish between these. And differentiating helps us support our aspiration for compassion and liberation from suffering. Anything that stimulates our senses can lead to craving. So the first hindrance is usually called the desire for sense pleasure. And what makes it even harder to deal with is this widespread acceptance in our culture. I mean, what are we told? If we don't like the way we feel, what do you ladies hear? If you don't like the way you feel, what are you supposed to do? I hate to reinforce stereotypes, but go shopping, right? Isn't this the thing to do? Go buy a new pair of shoes if you don't like the way you feel. You know, every advertisement, billboards, TV, magazines, store windows, it's all about these momentary pleasures. We're seldom blamed for satisfying these desires. We're told we should be comfortable, have everything we want. Here, have some chocolate. Stressed? Let's go out and throw back a few brewskis. Who in normal life teaches us how to really work with these hindrances, this craving, this issue? So senses are really nothing but these physical manifestations, ears, eyes, nose, palate, body, that have a sense consciousness. And there's nothing inherently wholesome or unwholesome about these experiences, but we have sense memories. For example, I invite you right now to close your eyes just for a moment and think about chocolate. Really think about chocolate. Visualize chocolate. Imagine yourself opening the wrapper. Can you smell it? Can you almost taste it? Okay, you can open your eyes. There's nothing inherently wholesome or unwholesome about that, but you can see how it grabs us. The problem is not the object of our desire, but it's the energy of the mind around that. Some of you are still thinking about chocolate. Some of you are going to stop at the hop afterwards, maybe. So the problem is it's the energy in the mind. It's what propels us. Somehow we're incomplete. We're just not content unless we have this. So for the untrained mind, there's just never enough. So our misery arises from this desire to constantly keep and experience and re-experience this pleasure again and again. The Buddha compared sensual desire to a traveler on a trip with no provisions. He says he gets hungry and thirsty, and then he sees a village and gets excited. But when he gets there, it's deserted. Craving, wanting mind actually create a mirage of an oasis in the barren desert in the mind. It's the distortion of the wanting mind. In India, when a pickpocket sees a saint, he only sees the pockets. This is how much the wanting mind messes with our head. So what to do? So we'll get to the antidotes. Well, as always in our practice, the first step is to just fully recognize and acknowledge the desire and the willingness just to observe it, not to chase it. So, you know, that peach pie, just thinking about that peach pie, is just noticing, wow, I'm really thinking a lot about that peach pie. So there are a number of antidotes, and to talk about these antidotes, I'm going to reference a book by one of my favorite teachers. She's actually passed away about 20 years ago. Her name is Aya Kema. She was German-born. She became a monk in the Vipassana tradition and wrote a number of books, and she's really wonderful. And this is from a book called Meditations on the Buddhist Path. So, let's see. Actually, I'm going to read something first for from a different book that I didn't bring. Oh, here it is. Yeah, never mind. I confused myself for a minute. Okay. So this is one of the practices that she talked about, that the Buddha talked about. Called the loathsomeness of the body. And this is one of the practices, talking about the 32 parts of the body. And he says, herein, monks, a monk reflects on just this body, confined within the skin and full of manifold impurities from the soles upward and from the top of the hair down. This is in this body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, pleura, spleen, lungs, intestines, bowels, stomach, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, lymph, saliva, mucus, fluid of the joints, urine, and the brain and the skull. So one of the practices is to reflect on this. So, Paul, when you were having the Vipassana romance and thinking of that woman, did you reflect on all those body parts of hers?
It was always the teacher.
Yeah, always the teacher.
Who's always the female teacher.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, in the Tibetan practice... In the Tibetan practice, we won't go there. In the Tibetan practice, what the monks often do is they go to what's called the charnel grounds, because over in Tibet, you know, they don't bury the people. They just take them up to the mountaintop and chop them up and let the raptors come in and do the house cleaning. So the monks actually go up and observe these chopped up bodies. You know, I was sitting with a teacher, Lee Brazington, and he talked about doing this practice. He said he was on retreat, and he went out on his walking meditation in a meadow, and he found a dead remains of a dead elk. So each day he would go and look at this dead elk. And then he came back the next year, and all there was left was the bones. I think this is what's the place up in...
Forest Refuge.
Yeah. Not Forest Refuge, but the place in Oregon, Cloud Mountain, up in Washington or Oregon. Each year he goes and does a retreat, and each year he would come, and finally the bones had gone away. But he reflected on all these body parts and reflected on the fact that his own body was going to go through the same process. So that's actually the loathsomeness of the body. Now I'm going to read from the book about the impurity of objects. She said, the most important antidote is to understand the sensual desire is an enemy that wrecks our inner household, creates fear that we may not get what we want, and enmity or hatred towards those who are getting what we want. Envy, jealousy, states of mind that are so unpleasant, yet cannot arise unless we want what another person has. It's the only way these feelings can arise. It's essential that one understands that this is the cause of our human problems. Wanting the pleasurable sensations, wanting the comfort, wanting the gratification, often not getting them, and never being able to keep them. Letting go of wanting means letting go of dissatisfaction. But it isn't possible to do that overnight, or just by talking or reading about it. It's a gradual process. The first step is to sit with an uncomfortable sensation. Not wriggling or shifting around in meditation, not trying to get out of this discomfort by changing position. There's no wriggling out of suffering. Suffering cannot be eliminated this way. The only way out is to just let go of craving. One can't wriggle out of craving. One really has to let go of it. So wriggling around isn't going to get us out of this pain or dissatisfaction. The comfort we lack in the sitting position gives us a wonderful opportunity to learn about our sensual desires. If we don't learn about them here, there's no other place we're going to learn about them. I remember the first retreat I went to back in the early 90s was in the Zen tradition. About the second day, I had a meeting with a teacher. His name is Kwang Roshi. He's out of Sonoma Valley, California. And so I went, you know, I sat in front of him. He said, how's it going? And I said, I'm in a lot of pain. And he said, well, let the pain bring you to your awareness. And I thought, what the hell? You're supposed to say, hey, we'll get you a chair. Because I was sitting on a cushion. Let the pain bring you to awareness. He was basically saying, work with it as an object of craving and aversion. This is your opportunity to work with this and work with it. Work with that physical discomfort. So there's a story about a monk who, and this goes back to the body parts. He said, there's a story about, I got stuff a little switched around if you hadn't noticed it. There's a story about a monk who is obviously an arhat, someone who'd reached awakening in the Buddhist time. And there was this man and this wife who lived nearby who had a bad quarrel. And the wife decided she wasn't going to remain with the husband anymore, so she dressed herself up in all her finery, her best clothes, all her jewelry, and because she wanted to take all that with her, she loaded up on it and she ran away. Well, the husband took off after her but couldn't find her. She had a head start. As the man was running across the street searching for his wife, he met this monk, this arhat. He went up to him and asked him whether he had seen a good-looking, dark-haired woman in a red sari with lots of jewelry, earrings, and golden necklaces who might have come along the road in a hurry. And the monk replied, "I haven't seen her, but I saw a set of teeth going by." All right. Another one is moderation in eating. And of course, this is not only good with working with hindrance of craving, but just generally a good health habit. But let's see where I have this. Page 53. So this is one of the things that the Buddha advocate as an antidote to sensual desire. And she says, this is one of the reasons for accepting the precept that monastics take for not eating after noon. Moderation in eating doesn't mean eating nothing. It's eating enough to keep the body healthy. But this is a sensual desire that is easily gratified and one that arises again and again. Some people eat 4, 5, 6 times a day. If we're able to put up a fence against one of our desires, we're going to be able to put up a fence against some more. One fence can keep out many desires. So the one that's so easily gratified and arises so often, eating, is one to start with. So that's what we're doing here, moderation in eating. She's giving a talk at a retreat. So one of the last one that we're going to talk about is noble friends and noble conversation. And actually, there's one more after that. We'll talk about noble friends and noble conversations. Interestingly enough, is an antidote that the Buddha talked about for each of the five hindrances. He says, or she says, to have the kind of friends with whom one discusses not gossip, not the weather, not politics, sorry, not other people, but the way of emancipation through the Dhamma. These kinds of friends are the important people in one's life. When Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, once said to the Buddha, "Sir, a good friend is half of the holy life," the Buddha said, "Do not say so, Ananda. A good friend is the whole of the holy life. There's nothing to take the place of a spiritual friend." So that's why we have Sangha. What is Sangha? It's having noble friends and noble conversation. And then the last part I want to focus on is something called guarding the sense doors. And the Buddha said this about it. Here, a monk, on seeing a visible object with his eye, does not grasp at its major signs or secondary characteristics, because greed and sorrow, evil, unskilled states, would overwhelm him if he dealt, leaving his eye faculty unguarded. So he practices guarding it. He protects the eye faculty, develops restraints of the eye faculty. And then he goes on to talk about the other senses in the same way. So in her book, Who Is Myself? A Guide to Buddhist Meditation, Ayakema guards us against a common misperception of this. She says, most of the time this is misunderstood and wrongly practiced. It's taken to mean do not look, do not hear, do not taste, do not touch. This is quite impossible. Our senses are there. We must look, hear, taste, touch, and smell. Our mind refuses not to think, as we are very well, as we very well know from our place in the, let me start over again. Our mind refuses not to think, as we very well know from our meditation. When the eyes see, it simply registers color and shape. All the rest takes place in the mind. So when we see a piece of chocolate, the eye sees only the brown shape. It's the mind that says, "Ah, chocolate. That tastes delicious. I want a piece." Not to grasp at the major signs or secondary characteristics is to stop the mind from doing that. We can practice this easily with anything we either like very much or even dislike. So, for example, if we see a person or even think of a person for which we have hate or greed, or someone we dislike, we should practice stopping at the label, person, whether it's, who it is, and just notice, stop there rather than going into the labeling. This is guarding the sense doors. And I'm just touching on it. We could do a whole talk, perhaps you have, Rania, on guarding the sense doors. I mean, it's a very expansive topic, but I just want to mention it briefly. And there is one more antidote, which is basically concentration. And in this shows up in doing the sitting practice. If in doing the sitting practice you're aware of these different kinds of cravings pulling at you, if we develop a strong enough concentration, it helps resist these from pulling our mind away. And we can do this by continually concentrating on our breath, bringing our awareness back to our breath to stabilize our concentration, to help ground ourselves. But this takes a lot of time. It just takes practice. But I know from my own experience that it's been easier to stay concentrated and avoid these kind of cravings if I maintain a regular practice.